Good morning, welcome to session 311, Riding Our Devil Rainbows to Heaven, Experiences of LGBT Mormons of Color in the Modern World. Please turn off your cell phones, you know the deal. Frederick Bowers, or Fred Bowers, has been part of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons International for over 20 years. Fred has served in leadership roles at the chapter and national levels for many years, including Washington, D.C. Chapter Director, Chapter at Large Director, Assistant Vice President for Strategy and Development. He is a current board member of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons. He is the founder and current director of the Affirmation People of Color and Allies Group. Fred, a former career U.S. Air Force Financial Management Senior Non-Commissioned Officer, is currently employed as a Management and Technology Consultant. He holds an Associate's Degree in Financial Management from the Community College of the Air Force, a Bachelor's Degree in Organizational Management from John Brown University, and a Dual Master's Degree in Public Administration and Management from Weber State University. Fred is a native of Fort Worth, Texas, and currently resides in Arlington, Virginia. And then Robert Reese will be the respondent, and I'll just read his bio. Robert Reese teaches Mormon Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. A former editor of Dialogue and former chair of the Sunstone Board, he is currently working on a project on the American Renaissance and editing a collection of essays on the Book of Mormon. His Why I Stay, The Challenges of Discipleship for Contemporary Mormons, was published in 2011. He is on the board of the Liahona Children's Foundation, which provides nutrition and education for undernourished children living in Central and South America.
Good morning. Thank you for coming, and my name is Fred Bowers, and I will start our presentation. What I'd like to start with is a quote from Audre Lorde from her writing Our Dead Behind Us poems. It is not our differences that divide us. It is our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate those differences. And Audre Lorde is an African-American of Caribbean descent, a writer, poet, activist, lesbian, and feminist. So, why are we here? The reason we are here is to begin to explore the stories and issues encountered by LGBT Mormons who are people of color in their daily lives. And of course, the reason for the title is One Rainbow, references the variety of human skin tones, and the other one, of course, references International LGBT Pride. So, what should you take away from this? What I'd like for you to take away from this is just a better appreciation of the experiences of LGBT Mormons of color. I want you to understand the unique challenges they face, how you could possibly better interact with them, and then also the gifts and contributions that they give to the various communities for which their lives intersect. So how did this get started? Actually, this got started as a part of a meeting that the Affirmation Executive Committee had with the Human Rights Campaign in December of 2010. At that point, we were discussing things with the director of faith at HRC, and one of the things that he talked about was is that as far as boards and far as activity with LGBT organizations, there are many people of color that are part of those, but he told a story about his work at Equality Georgia, and there was this lesbian who actually was an architect. And what she talked about was it's not necessarily just being present. She talked about she wanted to be an architect for change. So for me, that became the catalyst about the fact that being the only person of color on the Affirmation Board, that I needed to be in the position that I would be an architect of change for people of color in Affirmation. So then after that, we started a LGBT Mormon people of color group within Affirmation at our Affirmation Conference in 2011. And then in February, I just decided, you know what, since we have Facebook, we have closed groups, that we go ahead and start a closed group for our folks in Affirmation that were part of the People of Color group. So there's three things I'd like to cover with this, which is exactly what is the definition of an LGBT Mormon person of color, the unique challenges that they face, and then after that, what happened is to get additional thoughts around this issue, I went ahead and did a questionnaire. It's not really a formal questionnaire, but it's really something just to try to get some idea of what their thoughts were about some specific questions. So, we talked about the definition are actually who are LGBT Mormon people of color. LGBT Mormon people of color are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals that are non-white and are members or former members of the LDS Church. It was key that I included both members and non-members so that I could get experience of the entire LGBT group, considering the fact that some of it was slightly weighed in this case of people being more out in the non-member category. Now here, I just want to emphasize that this group is a very small group, and here what I show you and here is that some key statistics about LGBT people of color and key statistics about LDS, the LDS community. And what we find, of course, in both communities, people of color are a very small set of individuals. So therefore, what happens is that the people we'll find in this group that I'm describing are probably a very small minority of people. Now, one of the things I want to talk about along the way is some of the challenges that they face. And what you'll find is there's a constant tension and dilemma in their daily lives about, okay, am I gay first or Asian first? Am I black first or lesbian first? Or Native American first? Or LDS first or gay first? Or black first or gay first? Or Hispanic? And then, of course, what we find probably quite disproportionately is the true influence of religion and faith on the lives in their particular communities that they grew up in. And that does include LDS members as well. So you have the influence of the LDS Church as far as religion for them. And also, key thing here, one of the challenges is lack of visibility. For most of them, they're sort of like silent partners in this, is that they either may feel that they just go along and with everything else, and if they have a voice, they may not express that. And then also, we don't discuss LGBT topics in the church, so therefore that part of themselves tends to be invisible. So you start talking about, well, being a minority, to talk about issues, and I'm already in a minority place with being a person of color, and then you start talking about being gay. So that sort of makes a next level of, it tends to make them be very silent. And also the last thing about this is that the economic disparities, what you will find is that a lot of the wards that may be culturally minority, you will find the church will support those because they're minority, but you will not find that the LGBT Mormons will come out. But you'll find probably more in common operation is you'll find some of the wards that are not in those areas that you'll have gay and lesbian Mormons come out. Now, when I did this study, I said about lives, and one of the things I wanted to relate, which the study is actually derived from, and I'll talk about at the end, of an experience I had at Alton Equal, where they were studying LGBT executives of color. So I took some of those questions with their permission and looked at them from a framework of being LGBT and Mormon. So one of the things we need to talk about is they do have the traditional dilemma of being gay for all gay members of the, they have to come out to their nuclear families, friends, and possibly church members as gay. And then secondly is we want to talk about how they're included in both social ways at work and in the church. And what a lot of this happens is that we have to work with perceptions on both cases. As far as work is concerned, a lot of that has changed because some of the companies, of course, are really working toward diversity in the sense that they do not want to miss any piece of talent whatsoever that they can use for that business. So they make sure that they recognize diversity in all ways and try to encourage those things. However, with the church, there's a little bit different idea with that. So I would say this, that maybe the church should tend toward that way, that we all have unique talents and we should really dig into diversity. And I also want to talk about judgments by non-LGBT people of color. Being born as a person of color, you have your natural ethnicity group. So in that group, you grow up, it's part of you, you look for validation, you look for appreciation and love in that group. However, what happens is that when you come out as LGBT, you may become marginalized for that group. So with that said, also we have another issue, which is how do LGBT people of color fit within the greater LGBT community? And what you may find is that they have a common thing that their sexual orientation or gender expression or gender identity, that's what I want to get to, is the same. However, the people that tend to do most of the work in those areas tend to be non-white. To be white, not non-white. So there is a movement to try to get more people of color into the greater LGBT movement. But still, some of the things that happen within that balance, of course, need to be worked out. And that particular thing I'm talking about, it's also the assumptions by non-people of color, LGBT, which means, for example, in some cases with some issues, the gay community may feel one way, your ethnicity community may feel another way. So you have to think about, well, where do I fit? When people ask the question, well, what do blacks or Hispanics think about that? Then you also have to remember the commonality that we're all LGBT. So you have to work through those issues as well. Okay. Unique challenges again. I would like to highlight a couple of things. First of all, is unique issues and challenges in coming out at work and coming out in the LDS faith setting. The unique challenges are, of course, is that in coming out at work is for, if you think about being white and non-white, and as we talk about, there are more people and that are white that come out as gay, that are visible. So when you come out as a non-white person, you become immediately very visible. So some people, and that does take a lot of courage to do that. So it just makes you feel a little bit, as you do it, you feel special, but it does set you in a category of like, well, do I represent what all Hispanic people think, or all black people think, or all Asian people think, and happen to be LGBT too. So it does set you up for that challenge of you have to work within those things that predicament start to end. And coming out at work, of course, has been a lot better. As they say, it does get better. Again, like I said, a lot of firms are really emphasizing LGBT groups to help them really work into the community and get the top talent that they need. So that helps quite a bit. And the other thing I want to highlight here is the lack of role models in both work and faith settings. That goes again back to the fact is that there's not that many out LGBT African Americans or Asians or Mexican Americans or Hispanics out there. So the role models need to keep coming. But they're a little bit few now, but hopefully they'll keep coming. And whether we like it or not, racism, homophobia, and transphobia still exist for many people. So I hope we evolve past that, but it still does exist. Okay, next part is the questionnaire on experience, which what I did was we wanted to make sure we focused on all LGBT people of color from an LDS background, whether they were active or inactive in the LDS church. And I divided it into two parts, which is demographics and experience. So what I'd like to do now is go ahead and talk to you first about demographics, and then also share with you the questions and some of the responses on experience. First of all, this is probably standard demographic things until you get to the latter part here where we start talking about an LDS church background. So I thought it was important to ask whether they were a convert or not, and whether they had current or previous callings, to get an indication of their either prior or current participation in the church. And then also I thought it was relevant, since we're talking about their whole life, is to see whether they were out at work as well, and then whether they were out in an LDS faith setting, and whether they were attending church. I'm going to read through these very quickly, and so we will see them again, because I'm going to show you later some of the responses they had to these questions. So pardon me for reading through these quickly, but I want to make sure that you know what they are, and then we'll delve into a little bit more deeply later. First, are you out in the LDS church setting? If you are out, when did you come out? Are there specific events that led to your decision to come out or not to come out in the LDS church setting? How has your ethnicity affected your coming out or not? How have you been treated by church members and leaders as a result of self-identification or non-identification of your LGBT designation? What has been the effect of your relations at church on your partner, spouse, or significant other? Those are the first five questions. And then we have four more, which are, do you have advice or lessons learn that you would like to share with other LGBT people of color on your racial LGBT journey in your LDS faith life? What have been your challenges in the church as an LGBT person of color? How has coming out or not coming out affected your callings in the LDS church? Has it changed? How do you interact with LDS church members? What are some success strategies you would like to suggest for LGBT people of color in the LDS church? For those who leave the LDS church? And then lastly, what are some ways the LDS church can provide more organizational support for LGBT people of color? And as I said before, some of this question and the way they're slanted did come from the study that they did at Alvin Equal about LGBT executives. So I sort of took that framework and turned it a little bit toward looking at how we participate in the church as well. Now, here's the replies with demographics. First, I will tell you, as you might expect, it was a very small sample. Three of the respondents, including me, are actually part of our affirmation. And the other three, I was very fortunate that they responded and gave me their responses. So for this point, it's six responses for now. And like I said, it is a beginning. So if someone else wants to take this on and expand it, more power to them, I would love them to do it. But here, and maybe it's a little small, but I will just go through. What happened was most of the responses, of course, were male. I did not have any female or transgender responses. But the age was 54 was the oldest. The youngest was 18. And, of course, the average age, if you put all that together, is about 37, six people. Now, I did not ask them or give a, I want to say, pre-suggested response to ethnicity. And so we have a wide variety of how people saw themselves. And I sort of didn't want to have a pre-response anyway, because I wanted to really get their perception of themselves, so to make it free-form and sort of help that a little bit. But what you'll find is very interesting, because you had African-American, Mexican-American, and also Latino. So it just depends. We would say those are two different ways to say about the same person, but they view it that way by that word. So that's very significant. And of course, we had Asian Pacific Islander, and of course, as we find even more today, triracial, where we talk about more than one ethnicity in one person. So I found that of interest. Also, you'll find we had the whole range. We had gay, bisexual, and homosexual, and even, again, not putting anybody in any square peg and round hole, gay man was used as how they wanted to describe themselves. So again, it's talking about how they see themselves. And most of them were single, and only 20% of that was in a committed relationship. What we find as far as education, we do find that there's either a higher level of education past high school, or they're seeking to have higher education past high school. So this is a case, I guess, of where we are looking at least with this sample, of people who are aspiring to be more than just finishing high school, have a little bit more learning and education. Background, as far as convert, half and half. Some are converts, some are not. Previous callings, war choir director, gospel doctrine teacher, Sunday school teacher, assistant to the bishop, Aaronic priesthood, returned missionary, mission leader, primary teacher, elders quorum, first counselor. So again, as far as service in the church, a wide variety of things, things that ward members do every day. So we're represented that way. Out at work was about half and half. So that, I don't know what to make of that yet, but it was just that fact that half of them out, half of them not. Out in the LDS faith setting, half and half again. With some responses, again, I said I didn't give them definitions of, you know, we have to have this or the other. So they chose unemployed, not applicable, non-issue, so on and so forth. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the sample I got was that 3/4 of them do not attend church, only about 1/4 of them do. So that was very interesting in the case of, I was hoping that I'd get more people that were actually attending church, but in this case, I did not. And where are we on time? Okay, great. Now, we now get to the questions, which is the part I love. And this is the part I am so thankful for, that people send in the responses. So we'll go over the questions again, but now we'll talk about a little bit about the responses to those questions, which were open-ended. So the first question is, are you out in the LDS church setting? If you are out, when did you come out? We got a few answers that said they were not out in that LDS church setting. What we do have to qualify this question with is that when I say LDS church setting, some of these people, of course, were not active in the church. So the question, the way they answered it was when they were participating in the church, whether they were out or not at that time. So you have to remember with that question, it's sort of colored by that. So with that case, we had Carlos and Al who said no. James came out when he was 30 in 1988. The really, I think, significant thing is Paxty, who said he's always been out. So I just find that so wonderful and interesting is that in his path, he's just always been out. So that's really remarkable. And then Dyson told us that he came out in 2010. And of course, I'm part of the sample, but I'm going to speak my own part later, so I'll skip mine. But next we have, are there specific events that led to your decision to come out or not to come out in the LDS church setting? Carlos gives us a story about some of the experience we get even just being gay and LGBT in general in talking to church members, which is when he came out, this church member did not give a positive response. So that does happen, and I would say probably it's happening less, but it still does. James talked about a group, the Affirmation, in the San Francisco chapter that helped him come out, so he talked about that and gave a response. And then Dyson said he just needed to be honest with himself. So that's why he decided to come out. And then Al talks about that he can't come out because of the reaction he gets from family members about LGBT issues. So that is very significant, I think, also for some people, is that they may want to come out, but they are afraid of the reaction they'll get from the, all the stuff they hear from families and friends. And next I'll go to another question, which is, how has your ethnicity affected your coming out or not? A lot of these it actually says, not really. And so I find that very comforting in one way, but I also know that in my experiences, I've known people that really struggle because of their ethnicity, and the point we talked about is their families are of origin and their ethnicity are really not, I want to say, taught very well on the LGBT issues. So they tend to dampen their willingness to come out. And our next question is, how have you been treated by church members and leaders as a result of self-identification? Most of them have had varied experience with that. And of course, Paxty, I thought was a very interesting thing, is that he said he never let anybody treat him differently because of his sexual orientation or his color. He says, I am Paxty, and here you are, and this is the unique individual I am. So here we are. And then I want to just go to these quickly because I'm running out of time. But the first thing I want to say about these is that what has been the effect of relationship, church, and your partner, spouse, significant other? Since most of them did not have a relationship, they didn't say much about that. But Paxty did say that it didn't affect his relationship whatsoever. So what advice or lessons learned that you would like to share with other LGBT people of color on your racial LGBT journey, your LDS faith life? Well, the sum result of all these, if you read them, is be honest, be yourself, and, you know, just be who you are. So I found that was a very comforting and very, I would say, inspirational. And last, what have been your challenges in the church as an LGBT person of color? How has coming out or not affected your callings in the church? Has it changed how you interact with LDS church members? Really, for the most part, most of them say it's about the same. And then also we have just here is that Alex said that he knows he was born this way, and he likes the church, but he still struggles with that. So that's where he chose to talk to us about how he was struggling with being in the church and being LGBT. And lastly, here quickly, I want to talk about these two things, which is success strategies and organization support. First, success strategy is, number one, is simply two words. Unconditional love. And you can see that here. You can see that the church just needs to treat people with unconditional love, period. You'll see that common through all of them and talking about them just being who they are, which implies if I am who I am, then love me unconditionally. And then how we can do support is basically a couple of things which center around stop condemning people and just treat them as human beings and individuals. That's what the church needs to do, no matter whether you're an LGBT person of color or not. And then last, what we talked about? We talked about LGBT born people of color and some of the experiences and what they're facing and some of their stories, a little bit of those. So what should you do next? I'm just asking you to, there are many stories, many individuals, and many things you may not know that the person of color you see sitting next to you may be LGBT. So if they are, I invite you to talk to them and talk about their experiences they've had, the contributions they made, and what you'll find is that they are people that are very wonderful, and I think you'll enjoy the experience. So last, one more. I'd like to share this with you. I found this in the Ensign, which I think is a very wonderful quote by Elder John K. Carmack. is, may we look for every opportunity, therefore, to decrease isolation, increase inclusion of all, and enrich our lives with this diversity of human sociality within the bonds of unifying doctrinal beliefs. Like the international art exhibit of the Church Museum, let us find linkage through love and through Christ in his gospel. May the happy result be the emergence of unity in diversity. May we enjoy the happy circumstance of the Book of Mormon, when there were not to be found any manner of ites. So thank you for that. And then lastly, real quickly, there's a few acknowledgments I'd like to make. First of all, I thank everyone who participated in the study that I did. And then, of course, the LGBT People of Color and Allies Group for Affirmation. Bob, thank you for responding. I appreciate that very much. And also, Ellen and Mary Beth, thank you so much for helping me with this project. And Bruce Carver and Samir Samdra, excuse me, were the people who actually did the presentation for LGBT executives of color. So that's where some of this originated from. And then, of course, Alm Equal and the firm I work for letting me be out at work. And Harry Knox and Sharon Groves from HRC, who sort of got this idea in my mind going. And last but not least, the Creating Change Institute from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, where they often, with every conference they have a separate gathering of LGBT people of color. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. I think one of the delightful things about Sunstone is that there are many opportunities to begin exploring ideas and issues that are important in the Latter-day Saint community, or that may be of increasing importance. And as the church grows, as we understand more and more about the whole issue of sexual identification and sexual orientation, as we understand more and more the principles that Fred talked about, which are exemplified in my good friend John Carmack's statement about how we are to behave as Christians and as Latter-day Saints, I think that Fred's bringing this issue to our attention and opening the way for further exploration of it. It is a small population, but larger than what we know based on our experience. The double rainbow is an interesting image because it suggests those people who carry more than one kind of burden. I think that lesbians carry the double rainbow burden of being women in a more patriarchal, male-dominated culture, and their homosexuality, as do people who are disabled, as do people who carry other kinds of burdens in relation to that particular one, who may carry more than one burden. I think that one of the most consoling things to me about being a Christian is the realization that Christ carried all burdens. Christ is the rainbow. I grew up in a family, a church, and a community that had the double burden of both racism and homophobia. I grew up as a young man hearing slurs about blacks and about gays, and like most people of my generation, carried some of those prejudices into my adult life. I think that I began to shed some of those when I began to teach at UCLA in 1966. And as a professor of American literature, one of the areas that I was interested in studying at that time, when it was still politically correct for a white man to teach black literature, is that I began to teach Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin, and others. And in doing so, my imagination brought me into the experience and the life of black people. It was, to me, a wonderful experience to be able to begin understanding, what, to whatever extent I could, what it meant to be black, knowing that I could not fully understand that, but that within the capacity of empathy and imagination, I could begin to have some sense of what it was like to grow up black in our country. After I returned from my mission, my missionary companion and I joined the Army together and were sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia, in the heart of the country, as it were. And we flew from Salt Lake to Laramie, Wyoming. And at Laramie, a black soldier from Haiti joined us. I don't know quite how we got there, but he did. And so we flew into Orlando. We got off of the plane, got on the bus in Orlando to drive to Fort Gordon, Georgia, and we sat down in the front of the bus. And the bus driver very patiently came and said, addressed our black colleague and said, "You'll have to move to the back of the bus." And I said, "Oh, there's lots of room here." I moved over so that there would be room for him. And he said very patiently again, "You'll have to move to the back of the bus." And I thought, I wonder what the attraction of the back of the bus was. And I turned and looked back, and there indeed. Hit the B on that, would you?
Oh, sure. Thank you.
What there was that color line. And even though I had grown up in a very mixed neighborhood in Los Angeles, even though my paper route when I was in high school was to mostly black people, it was a shock to me, as it was to drive through the Georgia countryside and see signs outside of towns that said, "Black man, don't let the sun set on your head in this town." And to see, go to places and see colored drinking fountain and white drinking fountain. That was my first real emotional engagement into what it meant to live in a racist society. As I began to study and read these black writers, I began to, again, have that kind of insight. I remember one particular story. I don't even remember the name of the author, but it was called Santa Claus is a White Man. And a story about a little black boy who finds a quarter and decides to go into town and to buy his mama something for Christmas. And as he's going, he realizes that if he moves too slowly, people will accuse him of being lazy and getting into trouble. If he goes too fast, somebody will accuse him of having stolen something. Mm-hmm. And the calculation of a young child to try and say, at what pace can I move to be safe, was a real revelation to me. And it was in the shedding, I think, of those kinds of prejudices. And as I began to have black friends, as I began to understand more about what it meant, and as I began to understand and study about South Africa and other places in the history of racism, I became very interested in this issue, and as a Latter-day Saint, became interested in it during the civil rights era, and was privileged to have come across my editor's desk when I was editor of Dialogue, Lester Bush's landmark, ground-shaking essay on Mormonism's Negro Doctrine. As I read that manuscript, I understood that there was so much that was in my heart and mind that was mythological, that was a distortion of both scripture and a misunderstanding of culture, and found that that it was the beginning, I think, of a transformation within Mormon culture to shed those ideas. To some extent, are still with us in some forms, but they are greatly reduced. Jesus understands. Most people don't think what it was like to grow up in Nazareth with the burden of being called a bastard. But that's what happened to Jesus, because his parentage was questionable. And people could put together Mary's birth, the birth of Jesus, and how long she and Joseph had been married. And so the rumors spread within that small community about Jesus. And So you can imagine what it must have been like for him to grow up there. And then at each stage of his mission, he took on new burdens of being a heretic, of being a rabble-rouser, of being a blasphemer, all of those things. I'm very interested in, you know, part of my work as both a teacher and as a scholar is to look at the way that symbolism affects us, how symbolism works within our culture. The rainbow is an interesting symbol, like a lot of symbols that has multiple meanings. One of its meanings is to, as a bridge. The rainbow is a bridge. It is the sign that the Lord gives after the flood. It therefore seems to me to be a symbol that is pregnant with meaning for people who are believers. But it doesn't always have a positive connotation. The Sunday morning that the letter from the First Presidency was read in our ward in San Lorenzo Valley, half a dozen members of that congregation wore small pins that mine was a rainbow pin that simply said, "All families matter." I won't go into detail about the reaction to that, nor how some people saw it, but it reminds me of in Moby Dick, Ahab nails a gold doubloon to the mast, and he says, "Whoever sights the white whale will be given this doubloon." And in turn, each of the major figures on the Pequod come and look at the doubloon, and each of them sees it not for what it is, but as a mirror of who they are. And I realized on that Sunday morning, during the beginning of the campaign, the Proposition 8 campaign, that some people saw that rainbow and they didn't see anything. They didn't think about it. Other people saw it and said, "Gee, that's really nice that you're doing that." Other people saw it and reacted in a very negative way to it. The idea of a rainbow, it seems to me, is a wonderful symbol. As Fred talked about, it has all of the colors suggesting diversity. And in that bending over the earth, Gerard Manley Hopkins, in his poem about Christ, speaks of as Christ using that, or the Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost over the bent world broods, and that bent world of a rainbow, which has all of those wonderful colors and all of that spectrum and all of that beauty, reminds me of Christ and reminds me of the promise that came after the flood. And as you remember, it isn't simply the rainbow, but it's the dove that comes, and the dove stands for Christ. So I think that if we have hope for people like Fred and our other brothers and sisters who carry the burden of having two burdens that society finds difficult to accept, if we remember what that rainbow meant ultimately. And in an essay called "The Fire Next Time," which I've taught many, many times, James Baldwin uses that image of no more flood, as the gods promised to Noah, there will not be a flood next time, but the fire next time. And that fire, it seems to me, can be seen in several ways. It can be seen as the destruction, which is part of what Baldwin uses it as, that metaphor, that in a society that does not ultimately accommodate all of its citizens, is headed for some kind of destructive force. And I remember the fire in Watts and the destruction that came out of that that racial kind of conflict. But I also think that within Christianity and within Latter-day Saint theology, the fire is also a refining fire. The Holy Ghost is also the fire. And so as we think about that promise that there will not be a flood, but there will be fire, that we have the option to choose what kind of fire it will be. I live in Mill Valley, north of San Francisco. As you drive over the Golden Gate Bridge, and as you head up the hill to go into Marin County, there is a bridge that is, someone has painted rainbows over it. So it's called the Rainbow Tunnel. And a year or so ago, as I was driving through the Rainbow Tunnel, I went into the tunnel. And when I came out on the other side, there was a beautiful natural rainbow. It was a double rainbow. Another day when I drove through, I came out of that bridge and there was a double rainbow. Think about what that means, the echo of a rainbow, the repetition of all of that beauty and color and the symmetry of it. I think it's a powerful symbol, and like all symbols, gives us the opportunity to choose how we see it and how we act on it. And it's my hope that we will choose the fire. Edith Sitwell, in one of her poems, said that Christ is the ultimate fire. And I think as we bring his fire into our hearts, it allows us to respond to people like Fred and to others, not only with this particular burden, but to other burdens, with the fire that Christ represents. And it's my hope that we may do so. Thank you.
We'll have some time for Q&A now. Can you either please come up to the mic or speak loudly so we can get on the recording? Where's the mic?
The mic.
Fred, question for you.
Yes.
The mic. Can you like me to go up there?
Yes, recording.
Yes,
we're recording.
To be recorded. That's fantastic.
Fred, I would be interested in knowing how the African American community, say the parents of a gay person, reacts when they come out to them. I would assume that it would be the same as in a Caucasian family, but is there a difference in attitudes and philosophy with the African-American parent concerning this issue than there would be with a Caucasian parent? And I don't mean in an LDS community. We know that would be biased, but could you comment on that, what your feelings would be concerning that?
Actually, yes, I'll be glad to. Thank you.
Sorry,
I'll do that. Thank you.
Actually, I'll be glad to. I was having a discussion about this with someone, actually, day free yesterday. And I brought to mind, it's sort of humorous, but you may or may not know about Wanda Sykes. But one of the comedy routines she does is that she actually makes fun of this coming out, because she says, I'm coming out, Mom, Dad, I'm black. So, of course, she's a lesbian African-American. And so what it is that I like to use it that way, is that what she did was she was trying to make the point of how difficult it is to come out, but also talk about the fact that being black, again, it is one of those things that, because of the way the black community is it's sort of like, well, you're not supporting it, that's something other, that's other people, that's all those white folk stuff they do, those type of things. That's what you get when you start talking about these issues. But one of the things I do want to say about this issue is I do want to bring up a few current things I think have really weighed into that. First of all, of course, is the support of the NAACP for same-sex marriage. That has been a divisive issue in the African-American community for some time. But with them going back to that and saying we support that, again, people forget that Julian Bond, the previous president, started that path a long time ago. But with that being said, along with President Obama supporting same-sex marriage, and then also you had Frank Ocean, who is a African-American artist, coming out. He's about in his early 20s. So, and then you had Beyonce support his coming out. So what we're starting to see a little bit is that those people who would never want this discussed, of course, to their probably dismay, it is all out there. But the good thing is that it's all out there and it's all good. So it's my hope that they follow and it challenges them to think about the role that LGBT African-Americans in the African-American community. So I have that hope that we'll get to the point to where black parents will now understand that, again, sort of like the work that Bob and Ryan have been doing about creating an environment for the kids that they show acceptance, that that will come about for African-Americans too. So that's what I hope will happen. So I hope I didn't make that too long for you, but thank you.
Sorry I was late, everyone. I know that's kind of rude to be late, so I apologize. This is a question for either person. I just, for me, my relationship to religion, a lot of it is, you know, Christ has no arms but ours to do his work. And so I'm wondering, what are specific ways that you feel like the LDS community can become more accepting of queer or LGBT people?
Bob, Brad, do you want to say something?
Yes. Okay, thank you. Well, actually, I would say what I would say and what my respondents to the survey said, sheer unconditional love. That's all it is. That just like Christ, sheer unconditional love. That does mean that we have to challenge assumptions. We have to think about, now I've heard about the golden rule. Now, actually, it's the platinum rule, which actually says, not only you do unto others, they do unto you. You need to do unto others as they would like to be done unto. In other words, there are issues that you may not realize that are important to them, and you have to do the additional work to ask. And in most cases, if you just ask with the full respect of, I just don't know, and I want to know. Matter of fact, I do have to throw in one thing that I've learned, is in D.C. they have this street sense paper. And in it, they actually, what they do is they have the homeless sell it. And what it is the proceeds go to them. But also the paper features the stories. And there was one story in there about a Russian man that was homeless. So can you imagine being homeless, only knowing Russian, in the middle of the U.S.? And he said part of the trouble for him was, he said, it wasn't that, you know, I mean, part of my troubles was is that it was, they didn't want to understand. That, I think, is the crust of the whole thing. I'm encouraging people to want to understand. Is I can speak about acceptance all day long, but until the person on the other side of that conversation creates the want to understand, we will not get anywhere. So hopefully that answers your question.
Two things. One of the expressions of the Golden Rule is to do unto others as if you were the others. When I published Lester Bush's article, I invited other scholars and writers to respond to it, because I felt in dialogue it's always good to have dialogue. And one of the respondents was Hugh Nibley. And Hugh Nibley, after reading Lester Bush's article on Mormonism's Negro Doctrine, said, among other things, what's surprising, he says, is not how little we know, but how little we've wanted to know about this, how little we've chosen to know. In answer to your specific question, there was an allusion to this booklet that Dr. Kevin Ryan and I have just published, called Supportive Families, Healthy Children, Helping Latter-day Saint Families with Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Children. Give you some idea of this, Caitlin and I were invited to the White House reception on LGBT reception last month, and this pamphlet was published during the week that we were there. In the month or so since that happened, there have been between 4,000 and 5,000 downloads of this from the Family Acceptance Project website, which suggests to me that there is a desire for people to understand how they can do exactly what Fred said, which is to be loving and supportive. The great thing about the work that Dr. Ryan and others at the Family Acceptance Project has done is that it shows that if families do nothing more than show love and support and acceptance, it dramatically reduces the chances that a child will be HIV infected, have depression, be drug addicted, and dramatically decrease their chance of attempting or committing suicide. Simply by loving. What a radical idea.
I doubt that there are huge numbers of Latter-day Saints who wouldn't talk about being kind. I'm talking about straight Latter-day Saints who wouldn't talk about being kind and loving to their gay brothers and sisters. But the elephant in the room is always, you know, if someone were to tell me as a straight man that I couldn't express my physical love to the object of my love, that would make no sense at all. And so I'm curious to know, because I don't know, how many active gay Latter-day Saints, whether people of color or of other ethnicities, really accept the church's, you know, if you're gay, you're gay, but don't act on it. I'd be interested in hearing an answer to that question.
Very good question. Oh dear, our time's up. Well, I think it's one of the cruxes that we face as a culture is how do we deal with the question of physical and emotional intimacy. I think that we live in a world in which it seems to me there are, on the one hand, no standards and which anything is acceptable, and the other, which how one sets standards and what one does is a great challenge. I came away after 5 years of serving as a bishop of the singles ward in Los Angeles to feel that the only solution is to have a level playing field of premarital chastity and postmarital fidelity. I don't set standards, I don't set doctrine. I try to imagine what it would be like for me to have to make that choice of lifelong celibacy. I also said at one point that that I feel that someone who is asking someone else to do that ought to be willing to do it themselves. I don't know how I would respond to that. I think this is one of the challenges the church faces, and it's certainly an enormous burden for people who are homosexual to be denied not only that ultimate expression within the bonds of marriage, but to be denied all romantic, erotic, and sensual expression. We haven't yet figured out what we're going to do about that.
It looks like it's time to end the session. Thank you so much for coming, and had a great symposium.